Two things I have to say every time we do a talk here, unfortunately. First is, if you want to go to the toilet, you go down the stairs where you came in, take a left, and you'll see some blue doors at the end with a sign on. So that's where you go to the toilet. And also, if they're in the event of a fire or other major disaster, apparently, then we have to leave by the way we came in, go through the door onto the street where we came in, and cross over onto the car park on the other side of the road. So that's what we kind of assemble if there's a fire. And I think that's about it. So I'll...
Right. Thanks. You can hear me all right? It's booming, or it's not right. If anyone wants to sit a bit near the front, you'll keep me company. You'll be most welcome. It seems pictures better. That's up to you. Sit at the back. I don't mind. So we're going to sort of take an excursion through the politics of the monarchy and the concept of the commons. I'm shoehorning my stuff in a bit here, but I think it's just about, work. With particular reference to popular print culture and the way in which the relationship between the monarchy and the people is played out in popular prints in the 18th century. So let's start with this epic scene. This is a day in August 1786, when this woman in the nice dress there and the incredible hat walks towards her king, George III, to hand him a petition, and as she does so, hands him a knife, which he hadn't been expecting. And I don't know if you've seen this at the beginning of The Madness of King George, that wondrous film, Nigel Hawthorne. There's a bit in it where we see Margaret Nicholson run forward and poke a blunt dessert knife into the ribs of her monarch, and he sort of stands back a bit and says, "You don't want to be doing that, dear." Something along those lines. And it says, I got fascinated by this incident a few years ago because at the time it was played out in a whole range of sort of discourses around monarchy and around liberty and around petitioning and around history and around citizenship. And we've just forgotten it. We seem to have lost it. I bet you've never heard of Margaret Nicholson unless you happen to have read my gorgeous book, which has a whole chapter about her in it. She's more or less forgotten these days. So my interest here is, how do we make sense of what's actually going on here? Woman with petition walks forward, stabs king. It's August the 2nd, 1786. She's a 36-year-old needlewoman. And her own history, her own backstory, is that she was dismissed from service over a sort of a doomed love affair with a footman, which antagonised her master, who then sacked her. And she's in great distress and in some state of mind or other decides that the king can help. So she sends him petitions asking for help. She wants a little plot of land, which she thinks she might be entitled to because she is English and he is her kind of father. You know, he's her spiritual father. So she sends him petitions asking for help, and she sends 20 of damn things, and she doesn't get a reply to any of them, so she's fairly narked at the time that this event takes place. There's a sort of a fuss about, but once they take her into custody, they say, well, what are you going to do with this woman? Are we going to put her on trial? She's just trying to stab the king. This is treason, isn't it? And they sort of think about it, and they go, well, we're going to put her on trial for treason. In actual fact, the king was right. The king stepped forward and said, don't hurt this woman, she is quite clearly mad. And so they said, this is it, he's mad. He's not mad, but he was actually. He's not mad, she's mad. And because she's mad, she can't help herself. And so we'll look after her, and we'll lock her up in Bethlehem Hospital, better known to you and I as Bedlam. And there she stayed. No trial, no legal procedure of any kind. She was placed in a leg iron for the entirety of her natural life while she sat in Bedlam Hospital. She died there then in 1828. She outlived the king, that means by 8 years. And on the day that the king died, she was sad enough about that to wear a black ribbon on her arm, she later recalled it. So she's an interesting character. As soon as this incident is over, The events are embellished in popular prints, in poems, in yards and yards of newspaper accounts, in pamphlets, wildly embellished paintings. I mean, this one, this is an attempt at a big, full-scale Royal Academy-type history painting, recording a momentous modern historical event by a bloke called Robert Smirk, who used to design a lot of paintings for the theatre. And this is obviously an engraving from it. But lots of sort of less high-powered or smart paintings in this one. We'll have a look at those later. There are satires, there are Thanksgiving sermons by the ton, all kinds of sort of reflective polemics. The future poet laureate, Southey wrote poems about her in 1811 called Posthumous Fragments of Margaret Nicholson, and Robert Burns named a racehorse after her too. Peg Nicholson, he called it, was named after her. So she's interesting. How do we understand what it's all about? The argument goes back to the days following the 1688 Glorious Revolution, or it's the context of the Glorious Revolution. The most important thing I want to suggest to you about the Glorious Revolution was that it made monarchy contractual once and for all. It made it clear. Well, I say monarchs were always contractual to some extent, but they weren't, not in legal language they weren't, not in constitutional theory they weren't. Monarchy became contractual. So it's part of a social and constitutional compact between people and crown. In other words, it becomes a relationship. It doesn't work unless the relationship is also working. Monarchy, therefore, only works as a relationship. And it's a relationship which is informed by notions of constitutional right. It's not just people asking the king to be nice to them, it's making certain demands of him, because that's what contracts are about, they're reciprocal. So if we think about the monarchy as history from below, I'm not David Starkey, right? From the other side. So if we think about monarchy, the history of monarchy as history from below, monarchy can be seen as a function of popular culture just as much as it can be seen as a function of the monarch himself or of the court, of the more powerful. Okay. So there's a sort of popular idea in Britain after the 1688 revolution where there's a sense that the king is there by contract, and that contract is underpinned by key constitutional documents. One is Magna Carta, actually. I don't need to tell you about that because you all read Peter's book. but one is Magna Carta, and it's invoked many times. The other, of course, is the 1689 Bill of Rights, which I think is actually more important by the time we get to the 18th century to most popular radicals than the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta is a rather sort of forgotten, well, it's not exactly forgotten, but no one quite knows what it says. Everyone knows what the Bill of Rights says, and radicals quote it to one another ad infinitum at petitioning meetings. Through the Bill of Rights in 1689, kingship, monarchy, was remodelled along the Lockean rhetorics of right and of contract. Kings were bound to their people on sufferance, they didn't reign any longer by divine right. So we all owe them allegiance to the throne, but on certain conditions. We owe allegiance if the king keeps up his side of the bargain. So there are all kinds of wonderful little 19th century radical, late 18th century radical sort of visual literature that sort of put these ideas into some sort of context. This is part of a beautiful production called The Political House that Jack built, based on the popular nursery rhyme, published in 1819 in the days following Peterloo. And radicals were feeling that they didn't quite know where they were going to go next. It's time to remind ourselves exactly where we stand, what we are, what our rights are, what our expectations should be. What is this constitution under which we live? Can it be saved? Is it worth having? Let's remember back, remember back, remember back. The political house that Jack built is the English constitution, according to this lovely pamphlet. And it's represented here as a tripartite equilateral arrangement, this rotunda of liberty here, not unlike the one that now blesses the grass at Runnymede. This rotunda here with its three equilateral pillars, one representing the commons, one representing the crown, the other representing the lords or the aristocracy. Three pillars of the constitution, which together, because they are balanced and because they cancel one another out or check the powers of one another, it's a doctrine of separation of powers, above them is liberty. Liberty, resplendent, Captain Liberty on her staff, is held up by these three pillars. And we won't go into the fact that, of course, the commons didn't actually represent the commons and the House of Commons, because no commoners in it whatsoever. But nevertheless, this is the house that Jack built, following the parody of the rhyme once again. And Jack, of course, is you and I. Jack is John Bull. What we're being reminded of here is that the house that Jack built, the constitution of England, was not given to us or bestowed upon us or dumped upon us. It was one we fought for and we developed ourselves. It's ours. Jack built it. Worth remembering. And what is the wealth that lays in the heart of the house that Jack built? The next frame reminded us that it was his treasure chest. Here's the wealth that lay in the heart of the house that Jack built. It's a bit little blurred, but habeas corpus is there. Bill of Rights is there. Magna Carta, great, full of resplendent thing. These are the libertarian documents upon which our rights are dependent. And it's at the heart of the house that Jack built. So, the Bill of Rights, which is prominent here, behind Magna Carta, let me just remind you one or two things about the Bill of Rights, which are important. One of the things the Bill of Rights did was to protect the right of the people to petition the throne. Now, when this was understood popularly, the right to petition, of course, is completely useless, isn't it, if the king isn't expected to read the damn things and do something about it. So, have a right to petition, yeah, great. You know. But if he's not going to be expected to do anything reciprocal once he receives it, then that wouldn't be much of a right. So, of course, under previous monarchs, particularly under the Stuarts and the authoritarian Catholic regimes of the past, there had been acts passed to prevent what they called tumultuous petitioning, large numbers of people arriving at once with pieces of paper waving them in the king's face. You could be locked up for this sort of thing. After 1688, technically you could not. The Bill of Rights guaranteed your right to petition the crown for the redress of grievances. It's the way people interpret that's important, the way they remember it, what it means to them. It means to them that the king will listen. He is now the listening monarch, and he's there on sufferance. He's there by contract. I owe him my allegiance, I'll fight for him if necessary, but he will do this stuff for me. Petitioning is therefore protected, and also, very importantly, your right to bear arms in resistance to tyranny is protected. This is vital stuff. That right was done away with by some poaching legislation in the 19th century, so you can't do it now. But you could do it, you could certainly do it throughout the 18th century. It's understood the right to bear arms as an act of resistance against tyranny, and tyranny was that which might overthrow this perfect constitution that Jack had built, where the king was held in check, where everything was held in check, where there was a balance. You had to watch out for tyranny. Radicals, of course, they're always very fond of reminding one another that we had a right to bear arms to resist tyranny. The question was always, are we actually experiencing tyranny now? Because if we're not, we didn't want to get our arms out. How do we know when we're experiencing tyranny? Is this just a slight downturn in our fortunes, or is this actually tyranny? Now, these debates are meaningful ones, purposeful ones, because there is a sense in which, constitutionally, our duty may be to remove the king from the throne, to break the contract. If the contract is dissolved, he's gone. We'll have another one, of course, but he'll be one who does his job properly. So there might be a point at which resistance to tyranny is a patriotic duty of the people. We have to watch out for that. You get a flavour of a lot of this in 1788. It was a century after the passing of the Bill of Rights, a century after the Glorious Revolution. There's a centenary event to celebrate it, up and down the land. Every town and city in the country celebrated the Glorious Revolution in 1788. There were flags resplendent in town high streets with phrases. I'll read you a couple of phrases. When kings lose their utility, may the people find their dignity. These are not kind of wild-eyed Trotskyist radicals from the lunatic fringe, you know, pinning stuff up, you know, to get nothing personal, guys. This is not the way. This is not the way this would have been interpreted. You know, they go, what is this scurrilous stuff? Someone has pulled up, pull it down, put up something more patriotic. It was deeply patriotic to stick up a flag with that written on it, and everybody understood it to be so. Here's another one: tyrants disposed, liberty restored. Great. What they're remembering, the removal of a monarch, James II, and the ushering in of a new one who was ruled by contract. The Bill of Rights summed up perfectly in the Public Advertiser in 1788, remembering the Bill of Rights in 1689. What was the Bill of Rights? It was the grandest precedent that modern times have exhibited for the justification of any people insulted, plundered, or in the least manner oppressed by the unfeelingness of arbitrary power, it having legalised the natural right of resistance. This seems like sort of potentially seditious language, perhaps, to us now, and if you repeated it in the 1790s after the French Revolution, it would have been seditious language, but in 1788, a year before the French Revolution, it's deeply patriotic, constitutional, Whiggish language. And everyone buys into it. This is fascinating stuff. This is the way to regard monarchy. It's there on sufferance. You all know this picture. That's our Queen's Square, isn't it? At the height of the reform riots of 1831. And take careful note of the way in which the guy standing on the back of mounting, you know, I mean, the guy on the equestrian statue there is William III. Yes, William III, the victor of the Glorious Revolution, the man who cemented for us our constitutional rights under the Glorious Revolution, a king of whom Whigs approved throughout the 18th century, guarantor of liberty. And so, in the midst of the great liberty riot uprising of 1831, what do we have but a guy who stands on his back and toasts him with a great bottle of purloined wine from the mayor's cellar? It's just a wonderful, it's a wonderful scene. You know, there are eyewitness accounts, you know, you've read this stuff, I'm sure, but you know, the statue was not pulled down while the rest of the square burned. Did they pull the statue down and chuck it in the river because it was a king? No, they decorated it with a tricolour because that represented monarchy and liberty and the right way for monarchs to behave. These ideas are radical ideas that survive beyond the 18th century into the 19th, and they're important. But arguably we've rather lost them a little bit now. Now, all this idea about having a right to petition is very well, isn't it? But George III had started interfering with it quite early on. In 1775, in order to frustrate opposition to the war with America, he started restricting petitioning to a sort of official levy twice a week. It basically meant, you have a right to petition, but if you're not wearing the right hat, and you don't stand properly, and you don't know the right language, you're not going to get past the flunkies on the door, so forget it. But you have perfect right, all right? So you can do it, if only you can get in and you know the right etiquette. And because there were sort of questions raised about this, by the 1780s, monarchy had sort of done this kind of sort of neat act where they decided that although proper official petitioning would be done at the levy twice a week in proper clothes and with dress swords and everything else, there would also be an opportunity for the unwashed plebs to wait outside the garden gate at St James's Palace for the king to arrive from the Queen's House every day. You go to the Queen's House, Buckingham House, back to St James's Palace, back and forth in his coach, and every time he arrives back at St James's Palace, he gets out of his coach and the petitioners are waiting. And there's always a little bunch of them there. He would always go up to them and say, "Hello, and what do you do?" Because that's what kings say, isn't it? And he shakes hands, and they say, "Yes, well, what I do is I'm unemployed and I'm bloody miserable, and here's my petition." He goes, "Thank you very much. Thank you. I'll read it. Thank you. Thank you very much." And he puts them in his pocket and he walks off. And this is the way that the plebs petition the crown. They do it just about every day. The trouble is the king had been neglectful here as well. In theory, what people thought was happening was the king would give the petition to one of the lords-in-waiting when he got into St James's Palace. The lord-in-waiting would take all the petitions away and he'd read them, because the king hasn't got time to hear everything. They are a bit rambling. So the lord-in-waiting will look through the petitions and summarise them for the king. Come back to the throne room and go, "Sire, I have summarised the petitions. They are as follows." And he'll read them out. as his summary goes, and the king will then go, oh, very interesting. We'll give them all 5p, or whatever he decides. Give them all a castle and some land. Whatever he's feeling. That's the theory. What was, because it was discovered after the Margaret Nicholson episode, which we must get back to, stabbing of the king with a blunt dessert knife because he hadn't answered 20 petitions on the trot. After that, they're just plain inquiry. You know, what's it? Apparently she's had 20 petitions. They've not been read. They've not been answered. They've not been, how does this happen? What's going on? So there's a big inquiry into the petitioning process, and it's discovered that indeed, not only have they not been read, but they're in this big box at the back of the palace with thousands and thousands of other petitions that have been handed to the king over the years. None of them have been read. And the official press, you know, the respectable press, the Times newspaper, for example, which was a very young paper in 1786, is outraged. According to the Times, most petitions, it said, I quote, were committed to a chest from which they never stir. Till at a stated time, the rubbish is cleared away and burnt to make room for some more. This is published in newspapers. It's outrageous. So, so when, this is another frustrated petitioner, this man is called John Frith. I can't remember what his grievance was. It was very important. He'd been deprived of his living somewhere or other, and he thought the king should intervene to put things straight. After all, that's what the king's for. And when the king doesn't respond to his petitions, he waits for the king in St. James's Park and throws rocks at him. So there he is, with his, being arrested with his hat full of rocks, which he's been chucking at the king. He's just going by there in his carriage. And the interesting thing about John Frith was that what he says, once he's arrested, he explains himself. And he says, the king's majesty levies war with his servant and his subject by tyranny in not redressing grievances. This is the key language. This is the language we understand. Now the compact is dissolved, as was the case with James II in June 1688. He knows his history. He's not stupid, this bloke, but guess what? He was called mad and locked away in Bedlam and never got out. They didn't want to put him on trial. This was not going to be treason. This was, this man is mad, he throws rocks at the king. Put him in Bedlam. But we listen to what he says and we say, Anna, this man understands his constitutional theory. Not everybody reacted like John Frith and Margaret Nicholson. A man called James Sutherland was far more tragic. James Sutherland was a civil servant who was forced out of office as governor on the island of Minorca in 1785. And he spent the next 6 years traipsing around after the king with petitions, which he tried to force into the king's hand or throw into his cart as he went by, or waited outside the centre, here's another one, oh, it's you again, thank you very much, yes, I'll read that later. And of course, nothing happens. And in some agitation of mind, James Sutherland devotes 6 years to trying to get the king to respond. He says in the end, you know, it's not that I want him necessarily to restore me. I want him to respond because I understand that's his job. So that's what I want. He publishes a pamphlet on it. It's fascinating stuff. In 1791, he's clearly had enough. His marriage had broken up by this time, and he was sort of more or less destitute, lost his job, devoted all his life to getting these petitions to the king. So in 1791, on a summer's day, he waited for the king's carriage to come by in St. James's Park, impeccably dressed, as you should be for the levy, with his petition in one hand, and he steps out in front of the king's carriage. His petition's in one hand, he has a pistol in the other, but he doesn't fire it at the king, he points it at his head and blows his brains out in front of the royal carriage. It's terrible to do. They stop the carriage, pick up, who's this man? We've seen him before somewhere. They pick up the piece of paper and they read it. Here's the letter he wrote. Sire, with spirited and dutiful appeals and humiliating supplications, I have addressed you and your ministers. Allegiance and protection are constitutionally reciprocal, and as the former never was forsaken by me, I had a right to expect that you would afford the latter. When my hard case shall be published, how will the world be shuddered to hear that humanity had deprived me of every recourse but death? Another forgotten character, but he knew his constitutional history, he knew his constitutional theory, he knew what he was about. If he'd survived, I'm sure he'd have been mad, but he didn't. So what I want us to do is to take these forgotten characters from the past seriously for a moment and think to ourselves that these are not quite like the sort of scrofulous peasants who wait upon the Russian Tsar to Russian peasants who've marched through the snow to meet the Tsar in the hope that he'll commit some kind of act of magic upon them and make everything better. English petitioners are not like that. What English petitioners are doing is demanding a right. They're performing citizenship. It doesn't matter whether they're individuals like Frith and Sutherland and Nicholson, and I could have named thousands of others, or whether they are collective bodies. And this is where the experience of these characters suddenly impinges upon what we do know about our own radical history, because the theories which underpin the way in which the London Corresponding Society behaved in the 1790s and the Peterloo mass platform movement behaves at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the constitutional theory is mirror image, but it is about collective action rather than individual action. So you'll find the London Corresponding Society in 1792 speaking this sort of language. Are we to imagine some impenetrable barrier between the oppressed and the magistrate? That is the king. It is our right to advise as well as to supplicate. Our right to advise. We will advise the king. Don't tell us it's not our position to talk to the king. We'll talk to the king. We're the people of England. Thank you very much. It's all, you know, it's underpinned by the same stuff. So there's, of course, all this popular constitutional theory has a big impact after the fall of the Bastille in 1789, Britain in the 1790s, suddenly, as I said to you before, you know, to speak some of the words that were spoken in 1788 in commemoration of the Glorious Revolution would certainly have been construed seditious during the 1790s. It's a much more difficult time to talk about our own constitutional history. But at the same time, the king's theoretical approachability, the idea that the king is a listening monarch, that the king will come out and meet his people, that he will share a dirty joke with them, slap them on the back and do the John Bull sort of routine, that he is a farmer, you know, that sort of spin is key to his survival, or it seemed to be key to his survival in an age where kings are losing their heads because autocratic, aristocratic monarchy is no longer popular. So that the constitutional monarch becomes absolutely vital, but how he's supposed to deal with the weltering of petitions that comes raining down upon him from the people who want to meet him is another matter altogether. The system simply breaks down and doesn't work. The king's sensitivity to his people, then, after the Margaret Nicholson attack, has to be spun to save his neck in the revolutionary era. The idea that he has called for her humane treatment as though she's some poor deluded child is absolutely classic. The Daily Advertiser said at the time, reporting what the king's behaviour under assault. The Daily Advertiser is in awe of his words, the words of the king. "Spare the woman, she must be insane." These were the words which give the most lively idea of His Majesty's greatness of mind, of his command of temper, his fine sensibility, his humanity, everything laudable and amiable. These were things, the paper said, which would leave all Europeans lost in wonder. What's more, it went on to say, Margaret Nicholson's knife thrust was, quote, "happily avoided by His Majesty because he was bowing as he took the paper," which was a smart thing to say because it adds humility to his other list of fine kingly accomplishments. And then they like to contrast what happens between the king and Margaret Nicholson with what had happened to François Damiens in France in 1757. And you may not be familiar with François Damiens, but he's a bloke who tried to stab a monarch over there too. And what they did to him was, rather than say, "I think the man is mad," they said, "This man is certainly mad, now we're going to torture him." And that's what they do. And they pull him apart with four wild horses and they do all kinds of unspeakable things to him. And no one suggests that sensibility and humanity and civilised behaviour is something that should be extended to a man who tries to kill the king. So in the English context, George III can be talked up as the man who understands his people, who is the true father of his people, and works in a different way. But of course, this just puts the pressure on, doesn't it, for the reciprocal relationship to work effectively. We're going to pump it up, we've got to make sure it works. We won't pause with that. That's just an 18th century image of François Damiens about to be strapped down the torture table to be severely dealt with and then torn apart. I don't want to alarm anybody, but I thought what we'd do, I just want to impress upon you the extent to which the Margaret Nicholson episode impinges upon popular consciousness, the way in which popular prints in particular, and not all of them of particularly fine quality, I think you'll agree, just kind of rained down upon the British people. This is something with which everybody was familiar. And it's that key moment where the knife is presented to the king, and the king stoops to accept that kind of the humility, the openness of the king, the fact that he was going to hear the grievances of his people when someone tried to stab him. You know, how sort of poignant is that? Often you'll see him standing like this, that the openness, you know, here I am, kill me if you must, I'm your king, I'm your father and I love you. You know, that kind of, this is what the body language is telling us. There's a couple there. There's a nice one, in colour, but still pretty sort of roughly produced. He's very kind, you know, always sort of leaning forward to meet the people, even the mad woman. Lean forward to meet her, take her petition. She will stab him. And he's not surrounded by guards, armed guards. You know, this is the trusty beef eaters who are there to... And they go, oh, something wrong, yeah? And they step forward, but it takes two of them to deal with it. It's not some... He's very approachable. He's get-at-able, isn't he? There's another one. Robert Dighton did this one. A bit dark. Move on. I like this one. I found this one in a print shop in Bath. And it wasn't even labelled... with what it was actually about. It was called The Garden Gate at St. James's Palace, 1786. It was made for the French print market. Well, I looked at this for a long time. 1786 was a key date for me. You know, this is what was in here. The Garden Gate, St. James's Palace, 1786. Only one important thing happened in 1786 at the Garden Gate, St. James's Palace. And look at it carefully, and oh yes, here she is, with her hand inside her cloak, about to pull out the knife, the king stepping forward. Only a couple of beefeaters to guard him. An open, approachable monarch. Oh, hello, madam. Yes, hello. So that's a nice one. And this, Hunt the King. There he is. This is at Windsor Castle, in the chapel, St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. They carved the incident. It became such an important constitutional event. They carved the incident. It was the back of one of the pews. So here he is. And here's the arm of a beef eater, is it? Yeah, no, I think that's the arm of Margaret Nicholson. Right, it's not easy to be sure. But anyway, there's that. And then we get the portraits, the celebrated portraits of the famous woman. I don't think anyone had the first idea what she looked like, because she's different in every picture you come across. But she's always sort of very well presented, well done up, nice hair, big hat. Depending on which one you look at. This is one I bought for £5 somewhere. There's a lot of these about still on the print market. This one I love. I found this one on the New York Public Library's online image collection. And it's catalogued under Hats of the 1700s. Right? Which just goes to show that no one knows who Margaret Nicholson is anymore. And she's even got the knife in front of her. There's the knife. There's a fashion. I think if you look up on this website, you'll find under fashion, 18th century, hats, you get to this image. What are you going to do with the knife? You know, and who is Anne Nicholson? Well, you don't know. We do now. So I love that, because it was an indication of how much we'd forgotten about her. Of course, it can be politically manipulated as well. So that's not Dennis Healey. That's it looks like him. That's Charles James Fox, leader of the Whig opposition in Parliament. So it's obviously manipulable, isn't it, that, you know, the Whigs are looking to assassinate the king, undermine the king, get rid of the king, do away with the ministry. So he clutches his manhood, dresses in a skirt, the king feels him up, and he presents his knife. It's a sort of, it's a satirical take, but of course it was an incident that was ripe for it. And then of course we looked at this one earlier, but this is an attempt at the full-blown grand history painting. So all of this, all of this sort of the treatment of Margaret Nicholson paves the way for a tradition in which it's possible to spirit away whole legions of what we call king botherers, I suppose, in future decades. You know, people who just hung around the king too much, expecting a bit from him, expecting him to speak to them, expecting him to send them some money, expecting him to settle an estate upon them, or just talk to them, just have some sort of relationship. There's a sort of a precedent set up from this point on to spirit hundreds of them away into lunatic asylums where we never hear from them again. And you can read about all of them in my book, should you wish to. At the same time, it's helpful for government, of course, to see that popular constitutionalism, when taken too far, can be equated with insanity. So it's quite regular from here on to regard political radicals who seem not to follow the main agenda to be mad. You know, Arthur Thistlewood, Cato Street conspirators, they're mad, aren't they? Edward Marcus Despard, 1802, mad. You read the stuff, they'll tell you he was mad. He wasn't mad, but the politics are the politics of madness, and we need to remember that. So going back to the London Corresponding Society in the 1790s, here they are, petitioning en masse, as is their right, in 1795, knowing exactly what the constitutional precedents, the constitutional correct form for doing this are. They know what to do. They know. They stand there and they tell their people, first of all, as happened with Charles I, this is how we deal with it. If the king fails to redress petitions, if we send petitions, and by God, by 1795 they'd sent enough, demanding political reform, demanding universal manhood suffrage, if the king fails to respond to those petitions, and Parliament fails to respond as well, first you address the throne. You don't know this, do you? This is what you should do. When no one takes any notice of your petitions, you send an address to the Queen, right? Which is slightly more, just a little bit more kind of personal and addressed personally to the monarch. This is what you must do. You must take notice of the petitions which we've sent in and no one has read. If that's not responded to, then you send a strongly worded remonstrance. This is the language understood. Petitions followed by an address, followed by a remonstrance. A follower of the radical John Wilkes wrote in 1769, "To a remonstrance an answer must be given. If not, force and arms are the only remedies." Because this is how you know that tyranny is being exercised. This is how you know it's time to bear arms. So the London Corresponding Society placed huge significance on these constitutional stages you go through if you're contemplating revolt. You can't just commit an act of armed resistance constitutionally. You have to do it at the certain point, when it's the right time. So John Gale Jones, Corresponding Society orator, talking here about the reasons for remonstrating, when people said to him, "Why are we doing this?" He goes, "Well, I'll tell you. It will have this effect," he said. "It will convince the country that we have done everything it is in our power to do. And should he disdain to receive it, let us show him that we can also treat him with contempt and then appeal to the majesty of the people." It's constitutional. It's patriotic. You can't fault it. There's a sort of a duty of insurrection built into the way in which these organisations proceed. And those kind of themes are picked up in some of the other print literature. This one, James Gilray's The Republican Attack, 1795, about 4 or 5 days after the events we just saw, where John Bellwall is addressing a large crowd of Corresponding Society members in a London park, Copenhagen House. A few days after that, the king is attacked on his way to open Parliament, and of course the state turns out. Pitt's regime turns around and says, "There you are, that's what happens if you let people like John Thelwall address huge crowds of Londoners and tell them they've got rights of resistance. This is what happens. They'll attack the king on his way to Parliament because they're ignorant, they're unwashed and they're stupid, and we need to do something about it, so we need to pass laws that will repress them." So of course in the print literature, what we have is representations of London mob who've become principal members of the oppositions. Charles James Fox again here, this guy, sort of the guy with the huge eyebrows and the unshaven countenance, breaking into the king's carriage, firing blunderbusses at him, because he was shot at and a bullet just missed him. Meanwhile, there are the dead cats flying through the air, loaves of bread on hay forks with black crepe around them to suggest that the price is now beyond our reach and we're all in mourning for the loss of the loaf. Peace and bread on a French tricolour, but never mind, because government will find a solution. Government will pass repressive acts which will stop these hoodlums from exercising their constitutional rights. And Prime Minister Pitt, here at the reins of the horse, will literally drive a coach and horses through the Constitution if he must. And that's what he does, which is why, then, as you can see down here, the image of Britannia is seen lying with a broken spear and no cap of liberty trampled on by Prime Minister Pitt. as he rides through. Britannia, of course, represents our liberties. There she is, the figure of liberty, drives it through. So a very interesting print, because it speaks with many tongues at once. Here's another one of the. It's called the Petition Mongers in Full Cry. As soon as the what they call the Gagging Acts of 1796, the repressive acts designed to prevent the corresponding society from exercising their constitutional rights any further, as soon as those acts were pushed into Parliament, then of course it's an excuse for further petitioning, and we all know where we're going with our petitions. First, we'll petition against the two acts, and if they become law and our petitions are ignored, we will send an address to the King, and if the King ignores the address, we will send him a remonstrance. And then we'll attack his coach. And sooner or later, something will change, if only. But the petition mongers in full cry. The print, this is a loyalist print, a sort of conservative print, and it's suggesting that members of Her Majesty's opposition, this is the playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who's a radical MP, and Charles James Fox again, the principal radical MP with their French tricolours on, carrying... sort of manipulating the situation for their own ends, you know, carrying bundles of petitions into Parliament, signed by gamblers, poachers, and I can't quite read what half of them say, but they're sort of they're all signed by nightmen and scavengers, and bankrupts, and people that shouldn't be allowed to petition at all, in the view of the Daily Mail, which is sort of probably where this would have appeared at the time, and. And I really like this. I don't know the name of the artist. I found it the other day. It's in the British Museum's Dorothy George collection. The Gagger Gagged. And it's such an eloquent statement about the Englishman's right to free assembly and to free speech and to have a reciprocal arrangement with monarchy by which things will be kept free, by which liberty will remain. So on this side, we have members of the London Corresponding Society openly petitioning publicly for democratic reform and change. On this side, we have Prime Minister Pitt with his army and his convention bills, the gagging acts, the repressive acts of Parliament, which he's about to enact to deal with these people and stop them speaking, marching forward. And here, the convention bill is being about to be shoved down the throat of John Bull. This is every man, this is you and me, this is John Bull, the Englishman, who clutches his Bill of Rights, 1689. He knows his history, he knows his rights. His Bill of Rights in one hand and a dagger in the other. Fascinating stuff. And what did he say here? If you attempt to gag me, I'll be damned if I don't pork you. Is it? I think it's pork you. When you lay hold of my tongue, beware of my teeth. And this is not scurrilous. This is not, just remind yourselves, this is patriotic constitutional language. So I'll just wind up by saying that what we have to remind ourselves of then is that when we start talking about these sort of so-called, I say so-called because we use the language of revolutionary conspiracy to talk about Cato Street or to talk about Despard or to talk about the ulterior measures behind some people in the Peterloo movement, or behind the Spencean philanthropists, for example, we talk about revolutionary conspiracy, and we must be careful, because I think in the English context, what we have to think about is a constitutional, patriotic, if you like, it's an awkward word, but a sort of a libertarian constitutionalism which can sometimes lead to insurrection to restore things into their right order. And it's, revolution means something else. Revolution would mean that all these people actually wanted to depose the monarchy. And the fantastic thing about English radicals in the 18th and 19th centuries is that very few of them actually wanted to depose monarchy. What they wanted monarchy to do was do its bloody job properly. Which you might say is precisely what Michael Fagan was thinking when he sat on the Queen's bed in 1986. And you know, when they dragged him away, he went down a corridor, being pulled away by a couple of flunkies, shouting out, "She's my queen, and I have a right to speak with her!" Bloody great. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Any questions, then?
I haven't read her book, but I heard Lisa Jardine on Start the Week arguing...
1688 was rather less glorious than represented, that it was a Dutch invasion and that the king was imposed. Is there any suggestion, does that get any backing from the view of the monarchy in the 18th century?
I would say that from below it doesn't have any backing at all. But it's a question of how one interpreted what had happened in 1688. It's the radical memory that counts, isn't it? The radical memory was that what 1688 did was it really did for autocratic Italian or French style monarchy. You know, did away with that forever and produced instead a confirmed Protestant representative accountable monarchy which we can work with. That's the popular memory. And that's quite a broad... So we're not just talking about a bunch of radicals in a revolutionary cell thinking that. We're thinking about a large cross-section of the population cooperatively thinking that. And the people who then later become known as radicals or lunatics or whatever it is are just the people that hold to that idea for longer than everybody else. You know?
At what point did this habit of petitioning the monarch on ordinary citizens then? At what point did that kind of die out?
It hasn't died out. It hasn't died out. But people still do it. There's a flawed but slightly interesting book by a bloke called Frank Prokashka called Royal Bounty, which is which traces the history of he sees it as a sort of history of personal monarchical welfarism. I think that our kings and queens have always looked out for us. They've always responded when people have written to them. And they've said, what's interesting about his book, I suppose, is that he has gone into the Royal Archive and checked the accounts to see how much money was dispersed to people who just wrote in asking for it every year, from around about the time of William III right through to sort of George VI. You know, that there was always this kind of fund of money which was there available to look after people who needed it. So there is some sense of this, but of course, I mean, most people didn't get anything at all. Queen Victoria did give away quite a lot of money, and it was always the people who wrote asking her for things. But you could only deal with the tip of the iceberg. The point is the system doesn't work, because you can't have a system where really the king will always respond to whatever your grievances are, like your dad, you know, and put you right. He can read it and he can write back and say, well, I'm really sorry to hear that your cat is dead, but I don't have one that I can give you, and I'm just, you know, you need to work harder. He could do that, but how much time would it take? And in the end, the system breaks down because they neglect it. It's still there rhetorically, you know. And I'd say Michael Fagin is absolutely in the tradition of these people who thought the king, queen, the monarchy should be accessible under constitutional law. And so there are still people trying to break into the house, into Buckingham Palace all the time. And sort of create sort of scares about people. There was one I remember when I was writing my book, there was a front page of The Sun, which I kept, and I don't know what I did with it, but it was something about mad woman rushes at Queen. It was just classic. It could have been Margaret Nicholson, you know, but this was 2000 or something, and it was the Queen goes to Sandringham, and she goes to chapel on the Sunday morning to pray, and she's down there in the royal box, and some mad woman comes running down the aisle with a present for her, which she desperately wants to have. And the guards wrestle this woman to the ground, drag her away, and she goes, I can't give a present for the Queen, you're mad, we'll deal with you. And of course she's never seen again. I'm sure she's never seen again. Michael Fagin will never be seen again. You know, I mean, trying to get too close to the king or queen when they don't want you, you're in big, big trouble.
People present petitions to Downing Street. Should they be presenting it to the Queen?
Are you asking me what I think they should do?
Yeah. Is that something we should think
of? I think we do it less now. Well, I think what's happened is that since we now have some sort of governmental accountability, since we now have we have universal suffrage at any rate, don't we? Whether you think we're living in a democracy or not is a moot question. But technically, we live in a representative system. So Parliament is there and is accountable to you at the ballot box. So you might be more inclined to petition Parliament than you might be to petition the King. I think before Parliament is in any way accountable, The king is your best bet because he's non-political. Well, theoretically, he stands above politics. So if you're being oppressed by the state, and you see the state as a political tool, a collection of sort of evil-minded ministers who are trying to do you out of your savings, whatever it might be, you can petition Parliament, but they won't take any notice of you. Why should they? But the king, you have a contract with. You have a contract with people in Parliament. You have a contract with the king. And his job is to choose the ministers. So if you go straight to the king, he can remove Prime Minister Pitt or Walpole, or whoever it is who's oppressing you, theoretically. And he likes to claim, of course, that he is above politics. George III spun himself as the patriot king. And patriot in the 18th century meant above party, above politics, beyond all that. Friend of the Constitution, and therefore friend of the people.
I think it is
as a political demonstration. I mean, people hand in petitions to Parliament. They don't expect to get anything out of it, excepting some publicity.
Yeah.
They never expect any response from Downing Street. Maybe it would get into the papers better if you presented it to the Queen.
Yeah.
It would be a new tactic.
I'm sure it would. I'm sure it would.
Present a petition to the Queen. Stop the war.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. And
you
I don't know.
And
I don't know why it doesn't occur to people that that's a good idea. Or maybe the Queen has been petitioned for the.
Perhaps you don't want to get into the clothes.
Maybe you don't. So I don't know, but it seems reasonable. I mean, since all of those things are about obtaining publicity for whatever it is you want to obtain publicity for, so you expect the Queen to suddenly go, is there a war on? Apparently it's most inequitable and also illegal. I'll have it stopped immediately. Thank you very much for bringing it to my attention. But it won't happen.
I thought it was really interesting what you said about... first point really is what you said about the relationship between how the French Revolution affected the way the monarchs operated. That's really interesting. I mean, obviously, I assume it's a direct relationship. People having your head cut off kind of concentrates the mind a little bit if you're a monarch, doesn't it? I mean, if they then topped across Europe, you kind of think maybe the strategy they're using.
Well, you've got to be a different kind of king if you're going to survive. I mean, people have spent a lot of time trying to work out this. The first question is, why didn't we have a revolution in the 1790s? Or any other time, really? These are questions we sort of go round and round and round on. The other question, I suppose, why didn't we, if we didn't have a revolution, why at least didn't we reform monarchy? How come George III appeared to travel through the period of the 1790s and emerge from it as one of the most popular men in Europe? Apparently... read Linda Colley on this. She thinks George III was the most popular bloke in the whole world. How can this possibly be? He's a king, for heaven's sake. Why don't we get it? Well, what I've been trying to suggest to you is that we had a different take on it. Historically, we had a completely different take on it to most other European nations. We had a different sort of relationship with the king. At least we imagined we did. And that's the important thing, isn't it? In a way...
We've already tried that.
Sorry?
We've already tried that, basically. I mean, that was our experience. We'd already done it.
A revolution.
Well, yeah, and chopped off the king's head.
Yeah, we have, yes.
So we've tried that one. That's something else.
Yeah, we didn't consolidate, did we?
Well, it's
a consolidation. Yeah. Oh, sorry. It's a fudge.
I think the third point I was really interested in is about this idea that, I wouldn't draw too much difference between, say, France and Britain. I mean, maybe the tactics of the monarchy were different. If you look at the French Revolution, and obviously the early stages of the revolution, people might want to correct me, but 1789 to 1792, there is this kind of, inverted commas, reforming, we want to keep the monarch as a constitutional monarch, effectively. I mean, that's how they start. But unfortunately, with the right, the Sans-Culottes and the wretched get on into the political process at that point. And maybe the masses at those London Corresponding Society meetings as well. They may not have been running those meetings, but in a revolution situation, those people actually became much more politically powerful. And as a consequence, they pushed the revolution much further. And I'm very curious that, there's this very solid English tradition of the constitutional monarch, exactly the same in France, but when the revolution actually broke out, when they took power, then things changed. And the French Revolution went much further because of the actions of the mobs on the streets than the reformers who started it wanted it to go. So I would argue in Britain, if there had been a revolution in that period, there's no reason why it couldn't have followed the same path. Because when agendas become, when you're actually empowered in those situations, then the politics...
I mean, the big difference, of course, is that in France things happen so quickly. that the king didn't know how to respond. Yeah. So he wasn't like George III. He didn't go, oh, I get it. I wave at people and I tell them jokes and I do my farmer thing and grow turnips. And he just doesn't get it, doesn't he?
A bit late.
He tries to escape. They have to go bring him back to Paris. You know, he's hiding somewhere. It's ridiculous. So it's a different context, and that makes a difference. So I suppose it was an experiment in France, wasn't it, to try and turn the king into a constitutional monarch. And of course, you know, what they'd had prior to the fall of the Bastille was, in our view, English view, an incredibly backward feudal system, which we've got rid of long, long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing that in England, the bourgeoisie was in power, whereas in France they weren't. Yeah. So they took power in France. They'd taken power in 1640, whatever, 9. Oh, yeah. So that there was they didn't want to revolt against the king. They wanted to keep the masses down.
So they weren't in a position to lead as they were in France. So they didn't want it. I recognise that. I agree. But I'm talking about the fact that, you know, if there was clearly moments in the 1790s, for example, where in Britain, where, you know, there was potentials for the age of revolution changes. And so I'm arguing that some of the leaders of that movement, you know, may not have shared, they may have had an agenda which related to constitutional monarchy still. But I'm talking about, you know, even if you unleash those forces in those situations, you cannot be sure that the agenda won't change. That's all I'm saying.
No, I agree. We don't know, but then it gets a bit counterfactual, doesn't it? Yeah. Sort of, you take it any way you like. I mean, it's a fascinating question to ask, but you don't know.
So why did the restoration of the monarchy happen in England when they'd gone to so much trouble to get rid of it?
Monarchy of Charles II. I don't honestly know. My history starts in 1760, really, or 1714, perhaps. You know, just about during the Monmouth Rebellion and the end of James II. I'm not really remotely interested in kings either. It's just what I was trying to do was sort of trying to find a way as how can a historian who works on history from below, how can history from below tackle the subject of the monarchy? And to me, it's not answering a question at all. I'm just completely avoiding it. I'll tell you what started me on it was going to, I was in the Museum of London. I don't know what I was doing there. I was in the Museum of London, walking around, and there's a glass case, and there's an image of the attack on the king's coach in 1795, a little kind of engraving. And beside it, there's a piece of glass in a display case. It's about that big, and it's all got sort of smooth edges. It sort of looks like a piece of sort of been washed in the sea kind of glass, that sort of glass, you know. And it's there beside it, and it says, "Piece of glass from the king's coach, broken by mob, 1795." I looked at this for a long time. I thought, this is an absolutely, apart from the fact that it's a bit bonkers to put a piece of glass in a museum, why do we put stuff like that in museums? There was no context to explain why it was interesting, except that here it was, you know, you could touch it if you like. And it started me thinking about why it was all smoothed down. Because if that had been broken by a rock or a pistol shot, it would, and someone had sent a piece of King's Coach, we'll put it in the London Museum in about 200 years' time, put it over there. Obviously, that's not what had happened. When I start researching the attack on the King's Coach, we discover that loads of people were arrested in the weeks following for trying to sell bits of the King's glass, the glass from the coach. So what was going on was that in the pubs up and down the length of London, there were people with these things in their pockets going, "Oh, a bit of King's Coach. Broke it myself. I was there." And it gets passed around. And then it becomes a sort of a radical totem, doesn't it? These are the ritual material cultures of radicalism. You know, what do these things mean? Yeah, people used to pass around those Thomas Spence trading tokens. You've seen those? Thomas Spence, the great radical Republican in the 1790s, produced his own money with the images of the rights of man on the back, which were legal tender, because you could do that in those days, a trading token. And you could pass something about, and you pay for some goods with it, and the shopkeeper would take it away, and you go, "Thank you very much." "Oh, that's not the king. It's Thomas Paine. Pardon me." And you can still buy these in coin collector shops and things around the country, and they're not difficult to get hold of. But they, you know, they're kind of these little radical tokens, fascinating things, I think. And this piece of glass just seemed to me to be one of those. And they've missed the opportunity to label it as such. You know, these are the ritual totemistic elements of radical material culture. Why don't they have that written on it? You know, instead it was this piece of glass, King's Coach, broken by a mob, 1795. Move on, pepper pot once used by Charles Darwin. Move on, you know. That wasn't answering your question at all, but it's quite interesting. Yeah.
Right. Okay, first of all, say thanks for speech. Yeah.